Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show tactical athlete strength conditioning coach, Vanessa Frost. So we discuss a host of topics, from her own journey into the world of coaching, transitioning to training firefighters, hiring standards, ongoing fitness standards, training the youth athlete, prehab and rehab, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Vanessa Frost. Enjoy. Well, Vanessa, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend Trevor for making this connection. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here, and I'm glad that Trevor connected us. He's a good dude. He actually helped me rebuild a wall in my house at one point in my life. So I'm grateful to him for many reasons.
Beautiful. Well, very first question then, where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I am in Ding Dong, Texas, which sounds fake. I recognize that. It is, I'm essentially an hour outside of Austin. It's so small, we don't even have a post office here. So yeah, Ding Dong, Texas.
Have you asked how they got their name? And if so, I'd love to hear it.
So I've Googled it. I haven't asked. I should just I guess find the oldest resident of Ding Dong and ask them, but I've Googled it. And we live in Bell County, Texas. And apparently whoever Bell County was named after had two sons. And as I would imagine, I'm a mom of two sons. Sometimes I just want to call them Ding and Dong sometimes. So I guess that is how Ding Dong got its name, and that the image on the front is these two bells. And so it's named after the hooligan sons of whoever they named Bell County after.
So Ding Dong Ditch was basically them putting him up for adoption, probably.
Probably, yeah.
All right. Well, I'd love to start at the very beginning of your journey. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Yeah, so I was born in Japan. My dad, he works for Boeing, and he's been contracted with different areas in the military, both for our military and militaries around the world. And so I was born in Japan, and then we moved around, not quite a bit, but we moved to the U.S. for a little bit, and then I spent most of my growing up in Rota, Spain, at a joint American Spanish Navy base there. And so I was there for, I think I moved there right before my fifth birthday, and then all the way until the day I moved for college. My mom has done quite a few things throughout her life, but we were there for my dad's job. And then I have one older brother.
When you reflect back now, what were elements of growing up in Spain that you wish could be brought to the US, which could be paralleled? And then what were some of the some of the cons when you reflect?
When I reflect on, and of course, at the time it was just normal life, and so didn't realize it, but the speed at which life was lived was much slower. I think even I live, quote unquote, out in the country, not really, because I work just outside of Austin and such, but even southern living here feels fast, comparatively speaking. Now, and also I lived on a beach town, in Spain, and so that might also be another dynamic. But like, I haven't lived in a beach town in the US, and so maybe there's that aspect to it. But it was a lot slower. You spent a lot more time enjoying, and that like dinners every night were like a 2-3 hour affair where you were getting together with people, whether or not that be your family in your house, or going out to eat with friends and such. It was an all night thing. You weren't rushed out of your table by any means. And I do miss that. I find myself trying to recreate portions of that for my kids now. And I think those are the biggest things, but also potentially a con because one of the phrases like we grew up with was like mañana por la mañana, which means like tomorrow morning, tomorrow morning. And so anytime you needed anything done back home, like it, instead of a 2-day turnaround, you're talking about like a 2-month turnaround because it's like, oh yeah, they'll be back tomorrow. And then tomorrow's like 3 weeks later. So definitely some pros there and like where the focus was of life, the idea of like working so that you could live versus living so that you could work, is something that I miss dearly.
My mum and my brother both moved to Portugal down the Algarve, so the south coast, about 25 years ago, I think it was now. And
And they're
it's the
still
same
there.
thing. Yeah, still there, still love it. But yeah, the pace, there's so many upsides to the pace and the way they view the health of their nation, their view on decriminalization of addiction, for example, or decriminalization of drug use from a personal use to get these people in the hands of the medical community and get them back on their feet is so progressive compared to the rest of the world. But as you alluded to, if you want something done quickly in Portugal, you're probably going to be disappointed.
Yes, very much so. Something that I think, I mean, I didn't know any better because again, I grew up there. So that was kind of my way of living, but it caused a lot of frustrations in my parents when they were like trying to get things done around the house where they needed, different vendors or such to come in. But yeah, that it was a stark contrast from when I moved to the US and like everything happened immediately. So yeah, both, which is amazing in some ways, and then also, terrible in others.
What about the food? A number of times I've heard Americans say that when they went to Italy, for example, they had all the pasta and all the breads and they didn't blow up their stomach and, all the side effects that we get here. What was the diet like compared to, what we see on average here in the US?
Different, in that. And granted, things also changed over the course of me living there. And so I haven't been back in probably 12 years or so now. And so I'm sure it's changed, even more so from when I left to now. But sweet things are not nearly as sweet. That's something that I remember doing a lot of like during Christmas or Easter, whatever kind of holiday, we would always bring our neighbors baked goods. And like, we aren't a baking family. So that meant like Betty Crocker, like mixed from the commissary, like type brownies and brought them over. And they loved them. They would always ask for more because like things that were that sweet were not that common. Like, even if you went to one of those, like, I don't even know what to call them, like a, I don't want to call them like a bread stop, but like just this little kiosk that like sells all the pastries and things like that. And you'd get like, chocolate covered croissants and things like that. They were chocolatey, but not overtly sweet compared to like what kind of we serve here. Like occasionally I'll find one like that and I'll be like, oh my gosh, this is so good. And I'll give it to my kids and they're like, this is gross. Like it's not sweet enough for what their taste buds are accustomed to. And then again, depending on where you like lived and went to school, I'm sure things changed. I grew up by the coast, so a ton of seafood was very much the norm, which I was grateful for. And then I went to a school where they hired like it wasn't just like a lunch lady kind of reheating food in the back or like doing what they could with what they had. They showed up when we showed up in the morning, and you could see, you could smell the kitchen cooking throughout like the day. It was a separate building. And so when we'd go out for recess, you could kind of smell as lunch was coming. And they were like 3-course meal lunches. Like you'd have a soup and then salad and then the main course and then, either fruit or, on Fridays, like some kind of dessert or whatever at the end.
It's amazing because that sounds like such a crazy concept to a lot of people. But if you look at what Jamie Oliver was able to do in the UK, I believe it still stands. And what he tried to do here in the US that lasted, I think, a few weeks. You know, it's what we did a long time ago, you know, until there was Cisco, which I just learned recently from Joel Salatin. The food that's served to our schools is actually expired food that they get at a discount. So not only is it processed shit, but it's also old processed shit that then we're fed to our kids. And then we wonder why we have, 70% of our nation obese or overweight. Well, because we deviated from what we know has worked for, since the dawn of man, which is whole food.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate. I think something that people often forget about when they bring up these conversations is, and granted, I don't know the entire budget that places are working with, but I do know that people always prefer their taxes to be lower, and there's a cost to that.
Well, I think with Jamie Oliver specifically, he took the same budget because there's a misnomer. If you take local whole food and you remove the middleman, then it is quite inexpensive to grow real food and to
That would make sense on a more local basis versus like a regional, state, or even nationwide. That would be awesome, but.
Absolutely.
Do what we can.
Well, what about sport and exercise? What were you playing and doing back in Spain?
I didn't start sports until I was about 7 years old. I lied. I did gymnastics when I was in the US, so I was about 4. And then when we moved to Spain, we couldn't find any gymnastics gyms close to us. I tried ballet, and then the ballet instructor essentially told me that my body type does not match that of ballerinas, so I shouldn't be there. And then my brother played tennis, and so my parents were like, okay, let's try you in tennis. So I did, and then the coach told my mom, he walked up to her and he goes, she is no good. You should stop wasting your money. And so, at 6 years old, just tennis dreams straight, gone. Poor hand-eye coordination, which honestly continued throughout my life. But then at 7, I started swimming. And so I did that up until, I think I was 15 years old when I stopped swimming. And so that was most of my childhood there. In terms of sport, I didn't develop on land very well. Running was super awkward for me. And it wasn't until I got into high school, which then I went to I went to the school that was on base, so an American type high school, where I started doing other things in addition to my swimming. Mostly I was a cheerleader for my high school career, dabbled in volleyball and softball. And then track and field for one very, very upsetting season because running often was not my forte.
Was that short distance, middle? What were you running?
So all the things, because I went to a school that was small enough that if you were mildly athletic, then you were doing all the things. And so mostly the 4 and the 8, which no, thank you.
Yeah, no. My son was a miler, and he had this love-hate relationship with it the whole time.
Yeah, it's fun, but it's also not very fun. I would have much rather have been in the pool than running.
Well, what about career aspirations? When you were in the high school age, what were you dreaming of becoming?
I wanted to be a doctor for a really long time. I remember when I was probably 7 or 8, I told my dad that I wanted to be either a lawyer, a vet, or a doctor. And that, I get, I think just because I was very opinionated as a little girl. And so my parents always said like, oh, well, you should be a lawyer, which is where I got that from. But then I loved science, and I loved like bodies, whether they were like, it was interesting to me, like how bodies could do what they do, whether we're talking about like humans or animals, right? And so I wanted to be one of those things. And as I got into high school, I really wanted to pursue a career in medicine. And initially it was kind of what I went to college for, not what I ended up with, but that's what I was shooting for at the time.
So why did that deviate?
When I was in college, kind of a couple of things all collided in that. First, I was on an Air Force ROTC scholarship that I realized I did not want. Like, I'd grown up around the military, and I didn't want to actually join the military, and that, like, I didn't want to be told where to live or how long to be there or go here, go there type thing. And that is who essentially I was slotted to, the Air Force was going to pay for med school at that point. And so there, like, I knew I wanted to leave that. And then around at that same time, my sophomore year, I was starting to do, shadowing hours. So, when we were talking about trying to get into med school, the recommendation to me was like, go and get shadowing hours, as many as you can between now and graduation. And so I started doing that, and the more I shadowed, the more, probably disillusioned is a good word, I became with the medical system. And that, like, my whole goal was like, hey, I want to help people. And I think science in the human body is cool. And so that's how I'm going to do it. But the more I shadowed, the more I saw people and providers seeing patients and that had preventable diseases. Like, we were in a, you know, just a college town, not like a huge town. And so we weren't having a ton of like acute traumas and things like this. These were mostly frequent flyer type patients who came in because, you know, they weren't adhering to their meds or, you know, X, Y, Z, but all things that seemed relatively preventable based on life choices. And I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to try and convince somebody that they need to change, which is ironic because to a degree, that's what I do now. But at the time I was like, I don't want to spend my career trying to convince people to change on the back half of things in a reactive sense, but I want to be proactive. And so I, you know, made every parent's like dream of like, my daughter's no longer going to try and go to medical school, but instead she's going to be a strength coach.
So did you do that in college as well, the strength and conditioning side?
So I was always, kind of through high school, like it was towards the tail end of high school that I started getting into like weight training and things like that. In college, I was always active. I was in Air Force ROTC, so like I was having to train regularly for that anyways. And then even when that let off, I was like personal training. And then I started teaching like group fitness classes, but it was just something I did for fun. It was never like a true career aspiration by any means. And then when I like knew I no longer wanted to like try and pursue going to medical school, I was like, okay, well, maybe I could do this instead. I still pursued my degree in biology, which is what my undergrad is in, because that could take me kind of anywhere, a multitude of ways. But I was teaching group fitness classes. I was actually coaching at a CrossFit gym at the time. And I had met one of my clients. She was the softball coach for the college that I was going to. And she was like, oh, you're great. You should meet our head strength and conditioning coach. And so she introduced me to Clint McLeod, who was strength and conditioning coach at the time, who I'm sure was like just not even mildly irritated, like just straight up irritated that this little CrossFit coach was trying to make her way into the weight room. But I stuck around as just, you know, try and get into rooms and get around people who are better than you. And so I did that. And then that's how I kind of like morphed into a career of strength conditioning.
How did you find yourself coming across the NSCA CSCS?
So I was in at the tail end of my grad school. It was going to become a requirement to have your CSCS in order to work in a collegiate weight room, which is what I was doing at the time. And so that is when I went and got that.
So when you said grad school, was that kinesiology that you were doing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I graduated with my undergrad in biology, and then I pursued a graduate degree in kinesiology. And then during that time, I was a graduate assistant coach, strength coach at the Southern Illinois University, where I got my degrees.
I went to University of North London, did the kind of sports science, and then transitioned into 2 years at UF here to finish my bachelor's in ex-phys. And one of the semesters you actually did prep for the CSCS. And I never actually took the certification in the end, ironically. But it was the one class where I was like, wow, this is amazing. This is totally pertinent to training when I graduate. But all the other ones I did were just extremely myopic and really prepared you to stay in higher education studying sports science, as opposed to really setting you up for, you know, a career in coaching or being a better athlete yourself. Mm-hmm. What was your experience as far as that track educationally?
So I think where I lucked out was that I didn't get my undergrad in exercise physics. And so since I did get my undergrad in biology, I still use so much of that in the background in terms of the human body, but my graduate degree is technically a master's in education. And so I got, my kinesiology has a focus on teaching. I focused on motor behavior. And so how to teach people movement. And it was actually really applicable. So most of my classes were biomechanics, so the physics of the human body and how it moves, a ton of motor learning, which is where like I did my research project and things like that on, and then a couple other classes that at the time I was like, this isn't that relevant to me because my world was performance and specifically like a collegiate competitive setting, that where it was more about like public health initiatives in terms of trying to get people into exercise. What are the barriers to that? And so on and so forth. But now in my career field, I'm like, oh, this is actually a lot more relevant for me now than it was for me back then. And so what was cool was everything that I got to learn, especially on biomechanics and motor learning, I got to apply the very next day because in graduate school, our classes were from 6 to 9:30 PM. And then by 5:30, I'd be in a weight room for the next 12 hours. So, it was very much applicable. I consider myself very lucky for getting that because I do hear that a lot, and that people are like, okay, you're either going to work in a rehab setting, so they have you like running bike tests all day, or, you know, focusing on the smallest thing that doesn't actually prepare you to be a coach. So I got kind of the best of both worlds, focusing on the very small things in my undergrad of all the nitty-gritty science, and then a little bit broader spectrum and how to work with people in as a graduate student, and then got to put it into real life practice the very next day.
You mentioned motor learning. I've had this conversation with a few people normally when I'm trying to illustrate the importance of sleep in the fire service. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about when you learn a skill, the importance of sleep to process that skill and be a little bit better the next day.
Yeah. So, I mean, I tell people all the time, and you know, we just started a cadet class and I was actually talking to them. We started on Monday. So what, 4 days ago now? And when I spoke to them, I'm like, EMT school isn't very physically demanding, but it is very, mentally demanding in the sense that you have a ton to learn, and the learning you might think happens in the classroom, but it doesn't. The learning is how much did you remember the next day after your brain was able to rest and try and push all of that from, you know, your short-term memory into your long-term memory so you can recall it. And the same is true in terms of like motor learning and behavior patterns. Or motor behavior patterns, and that your body does need to rest and recover. So that way you can, same thing, it's all has to do with our brain and how we process things, right? And so that way your body can recall those same things. What people call muscle memory is referred to as procedural memory, in that it's not your muscles that remember how to do them, it's your nervous system and your brain, and kind of like what pathways are more active, and they do that through sleep.
Yeah, I think this is what's important. When I think about, you know, the shifts that I worked, and there are people out there working even longer now, you know, mm-hmm. if you are going to be doing rope rescue training or, you know, ALS training or whatever it is, and then the next day I've had this, like, I can't remember how to tie that knot. It's because mm-hmm. if you haven't slept that night, you haven't given the body the ability to actually take that and file it away and then be able to retrieve it the next day and in slightly better. So if we really want to take the performance side of, you know, fire and EMS seriously, it's another, you know, another piece of evidence in the case for a healthy firefighter work week, because we just mm-hmm. simply cannot advance our learning if we're not giving the brain time to process what we did the night before.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, being able to sleep is, whenever I teach, there's like five pillars of health and performance that I teach on. And the first one is sleep. And my like one phrase is like, sleep is the magic pill. And that if there's anything you want to improve, like whether we're talking about like your health in terms of like your, you know, your lab work and things like that, your performance on the fire ground or fitness, or if you want to improve your nutrition, sleeping better. If you want to improve your mental health, sleeping better. If you want to improve your relationships, sleeping better. So that way you're not a jerk or an asshole to people when you interact with them. Sleep is the magic pill that unfortunately for the majority of the fire service, they never get to take all that frequently.
Yeah. Well, there's a revolution happening, and people listen to this podcast a lot have heard me talking about the 24/72, mm-hmm. but it's happening in Florida. Now we're up to 10 fire departments in the last 2 years go to a 42-hour work week, 24/72.
Awesome.
So I think this is what's so beautiful is, you know, initially it was really, you know, the deaths, the suicides, the cancers, the, you know, cardiac issues, but now we can start switching into the performance and say, well, look, this is how much better of a firefighter, of a paramedic you will be if you are giving the same kind of environment that we would give an athlete. Now, yes, you have to be awake every fourth day now, but you've got this extra rest and recovery. And, you know, now we've shown the young candidates that we actually care enough about them. Now, all of a sudden, you've got a much higher recruitment, and now you don't have these vacancies with this mandatory overtime either. So it's like this beautiful, you know, solution to it, but it's taken a long time to build this case to get people to understand the why, that you just cannot just keep squeezing blood out of a stone, because you're going to end up with what we've got, which is a nationwide recruitment crisis.
I've been at my department for almost 10 years now, and what is cool is to see people who have been there, like who got there after I've gotten there. And so all they've known in the world of like health and fitness, right, is that we teach on it from day one. And now that's not to say like every single person is the epitome of all those behaviors we teach on, right? But that it is so normal of a conversation that it's almost, you know, just like talking about types of knots, you know, amongst a crew. And so I think with time that will happen too, in terms of, I mean, it's starting to happen, but it'll happen even more so with hopefully the work week schedule. And 24/72 sounds awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I'm hearing so far. I don't get to enjoy it. I left the fire service 2 years ago, but hopefully other people are. All right. So you now, you know, you're working in this collegiate setting at the moment. Mm-hmm. Did you stay working with athletes, sporting athletes before in being introduced to the first responder professions?
So I did for a little bit. So I was in grad school for 2 years where I was coaching there. And then I actually stayed at that same school, post-grad school, as an assistant. And so I was no longer a student, working as a full-time assistant strength conditioning coach there, which actually I loved that. That was so much fun. But I only got to do that tidbit for about half a year. And then at the back half of that year, I had to fill the role of interim head my head coach left for another school. And so they didn't fill that position quickly, especially not in the middle of the year. You're not going to fill that position until summertime in between kind of school years. And so I was the interim head for 6 months, and there's a lot I look back on, and I grew a lot from that, but it was not a time that I enjoyed. I was 25. I wasn't ready for the like micro politics that is working in a collegiate setting, and coaches and things like that. It was a very stressful position that, I did the best I could, but definitely wasn't prepared for on a managerial level. And so I was ready to leave the collegiate setting after that, especially if it was like, oh, this is the top of the pyramid, right? Being ahead, somewhere is the top of the pyramid. And granted, it'll look a little different depending on what school you get to, what sports you work with, so on and so forth. But I was like, this isn't it. This ain't for me. And so I wanted out of collegiates, and honestly, I didn't care what I was going to. I was competing in weightlifting at the time, and my main focus at that time was to make a world team. And so I was ready to move specifically closer to Texas, ideally in Texas, because my coach was here at that time. And so I was like, cool. I would travel back and forth from Illinois to Texas just to train. And so I was like, I'm going to move to Texas. I was applying for like personal training jobs at your local gym. I was applying to be a bank teller, banks, just so that I was like, I just need, you know, something that can help sustain my training, essentially. And then as I'm looking for jobs, my position popped up as a health and fitness coordinator in Pflugerville. And it was very like, I don't know, I guess all the stars aligned in that it's like, well, I've never like, I'd individually worked and coached with a few paramedics and firefighters in Illinois, but never on like an entity level. But I was like, I know how to coach people. I know how to teach people how to move. And I've worked with everybody from, you know, 70-year-old grandmothers to 6-year-old children at all aspects of life and ability levels. And so, it popped up and kind of just all worked out, and that I applied for it and thankfully got the job. And, you know, here I am almost 10 years later.
When you said weightlifting, was that Olympic weightlifting?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What level?
I never made the world team.
You got pretty high then.
I was, a couple podium finishes, I think like probably 15, 16, 17. I think a second place nationals was probably my best finish. And then late 17, I got pregnant with my first son. And so my truly competitive career kind of ended there.
Well, the reason I asked is you'd mentioned about being told you didn't have the body for a ballerina. Then the hand-eye coordination for tennis. I think this is something that I think it needs to be discussed. People look at Instagram now and they look at, for example, our world, you know, the roided out beard wearing alpha, self-named alpha. And then people are like, oh, I want to be like that guy. And there's very little discussion on, you know, the body types, you know, mesomorph, ectomorph, et cetera. So talk to me about that, because here you are being told you're the wrong body type for one thing, which again, had you said come hell or high water, I'm going to dance, you'd still be able to do that. You'd still be able to be, you know, perform in ballet, but would you be at the top level? Maybe not.
Yeah.
But you know, what am I trying to say here? The disappointment of being told that you're the wrong fit for one thing usually means that, that means I'm the right fit for something else then. So talk to me about that, you know, the perception of this air quotes perfect body compared to the spectrum of body types that we all exist in.
Yeah, I think thankfully, you know, you say like on social media, the like self-perpetuated alpha, like there are some definitely like negative things that are seen from social media. But I think something that's really cool that I've gotten to see over the years is And maybe this is more in the female space, maybe not as much the male space, I'm not sure, but I get to see those different possibilities now. Like my friends who have daughters, their daughters get to grow up seeing different possibilities. Whereas like when I was a 7-year-old being told that I'm never going to be a good ballerina because I was too fat, like I didn't know there was anything else. And so there, whether people like it or not, your genetics play a factor into how good you're going to be at something. Now you can, you know, do amazingly almost in spite of them. Like maybe I'm going to be 5'5" and still an amazing swimmer. But if an amazing swimmer is 6'2" up against an amazing swimmer who's 5'5", like the person who's 6'2" is going to win. Like you can still be amazing and you can work amazingly hard, but like when talent works hard, it's like the idea of like when talent works hard, like game over. And so your, you know, different body types are going to lead into different things. And like, that's your genetic component, even down to like, I remember getting my like genetic code done for some kind of like health metric essentially. And they were looking at different snippets and the the doctor who was talking to me was like, are you a strength athlete? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, I can tell. And that like, that's probably what you would do better at. And that your endurance, like traditionally speaking, women are better at endurance, versus like true concentric strength and power. Whereas like, that's not where I lean towards. And so I think that's something also that needs to be talked about that maybe ties into this, or I'm going off on a completely different tangent, is that when people are young, exposing them to a variety of things, one, for the reason that we talked about, in that like they're going to discover something that maybe they're better at or like in comparison to others. And then the tangent would be in that it's also going to help them like developmentally be stronger, have more resilient bodies, be less prone to injury in the future, and so on and so forth. But I mean, your body type's going to play a role into quote unquote what you're good at. And if we think about the fire ground, like I talk to people about this all the time, like firefighting is like a big person's game. And when I say big person, I mean like a large body, like a taller person has more, like it's a lot easier to throw a 24-foot ladder when you're 6'2" versus when you're 5'2". It's a lot easier to haul 70 pounds of gear when I weigh 200 pounds versus if I weigh 130. And so like your body type size, it plays a role. That's not to say it's going to limit you forever and ever, but it's something you need to take into consideration.
There's something I ask a lot of the coaches and people that were high level athletes when they were younger. The backstory, when I first came to the States, and I've said this many times on here, so people have probably heard it, you know, way too much, but I kept, you know, after being here a little while, I kept hearing the same, what I call Uncle Rico story. Well, I woulda, shoulda, coulda, if it wasn't for my ACL, my MCL, my labrum, et cetera, et cetera. And these are people that are, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and now they're very deconditioned. And so it was really when I started the podcast, I really started unpacking, like, what are we doing to our children, our youth athletes? Because you have this high level of performance in high school that you don't see in British schools, not when I was growing up, at least. The best footballers obviously would get groomed and you know, sent mm-hmm. through you know, training routes that ended up at Liverpool, Manchester, and everyone else. But the rest of us just played sports. That was it. But after you finished school, people kept playing sports, cricket and rugby mm-hmm. and football, you know, pub leagues and local leagues. But here you saw this super high level, you know, the weight rooms and all this kind of things in high schools and colleges. But then this steep drop off, you know, when there was, you know, mental burnout, injuries, et cetera. And you didn't have this environment for continued sports participation in 30, 40-year-olds that you do see in other places in Europe. So to me, what I realize is that in some areas, the performance, you know, the result of a game is more important than the well-being and longevity of the youth athlete. So what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was actually talking to one of our assistant coaches this week about kind of this idea. in that I, similar to you in that, like in Spain, when you're growing up, like you play sports in school, but it's as like part of PE class. Like at least in the school that I went to, we like, in like the neighboring schools, we didn't have organized sport the way they do in like middle school and high school here. That's all club. And so if you're participating in club, like, yes, they do care about like winning and such, but also because there's so many years prior to even reaching that point, unless you're like such high level, you're being pulled out and essentially like groomed to participate in sport. You're playing for fun. Like I don't want to say strict fun. Like they take it seriously, but it's still fun. And that, here, I think we as a country of in the US, we put so much value in high level athletics that it becomes the thing. And that, like, and this is again a bias that I recognize in myself too. Like, we didn't grow up watching sports in my family, like, we didn't watch sports on TV or anything like that. So, I didn't grow up, putting a high value on professional athletes, like any more than any other profession. Right. And so like, I thought they were cool. Like, that's awesome, but they weren't like the ultimate. Whereas here now as an adult, like I look at what professions get put up, you know, on the billboards that every kid wants to be, it's a professional athlete, which like the performance coach in me loves. I'm like, yes, like, this person wants to play sports for the rest of their life, which is so cool. But also I think it's a disservice because then if you're not that, then what are you? Like, if that's what I'm striving for, which like the majority of football players I worked with in college, like you're not going to the NFL. Like, and most of the people aren't even making it to the collegiate level. Like percentage wise, I don't know what those are off the top of my head, but they are teeny tiny. And so, like, if not that, then what am I? And I think that's where, like, I think I've heard you call them Uncle Rico stories, right? Of here is that's where that comes into, because if I couldn't be that, then why even bother? Why even bother to continue participating if I couldn't level up? Well, first of all, hopefully because of the love of the game, if that's what you were playing, right? But even below that, because we're human bodies and we're, you know, we're meant to move our bodies. That's how they, like how they work the best. And so for like your health and your longevity purposes, that would be why. But if it wasn't, you know, I didn't do it just for the love of the game, then why do it at all? Which to a degree I get, because like when I couldn't compete the way I wanted to, I was like, screw it, I'm not going to compete. But doesn't mean I stopped doing. Like, I still did, just chose like, okay, I'm not going to be a recreational competition, like, and do true club, but like I can still do.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting unpacking it as well, because you have this oh god, what's that? I don't know why my brain's not working very well today. This what is that term where a specificity? There we go. It got there. Mm-hmm. Eventually.
Yeah.
So you've got these kids now, and let's say they're, you know, baseball pitcher, and they're pitching, mm-hmm. and they're doing these strength and conditioning camps, and they're doing travel ball, and then they blow their shoulder out when they're 15 years old. And you listen to, again, so many coaches like yourself, mm-hmm. and athletes as well. It's the multi-sport athletes that tend mm-hmm. to do the best. And you think about it, mentally, they're not just doing this one sport over and over again, but also physically, all those different planes of motion, all the different, you know, mm-hmm. team dynamics, it makes perfect sense. But there's so much money in this kind of, you know, training the youth athlete. And I've always said this, like, are you telling me, for example, if you live in Florida and your child is into baseball, that no one in the state of Florida can challenge your child, that your child is so good that you have to go to Georgia or North Carolina? It doesn't even make any sense when you think about it.
It is. I have two boys, a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. The 4-year-old does like swim class to like learn how to swim and things like that, but he's not really interested in sport right now. My 7-year-old, he does jujitsu. And like he's played soccer and things like that, but we haven't, he's into jujitsu and that's his thing, which is cool because it's kind of a different youth sport model than what I hear, like, you know, my friends and my coworkers talk about when they're like doing baseball for like 7 months out of the year or something like that. And, you know, traveling and all these sorts of things. I've coached at the, like, I've done a couple hockey camps. I've taught yoga at hockey camp, which is like so funny, but teaching 6 year olds how to do yoga is a challenge and a really fun endeavor. But these kids are specializing. I was going to say specializing really young. And I see how it happens because I too am a parent. Like, I see how you participate in one thing and you're like, oh, they're doing okay, but they love it. I want them to be able to do better and enjoy it because they like it when they win. And so we're going to do more of it because when I do more of it, then they get better at it. In motor behavior, there is an entire line of research around how you look at practice. And you could throw whatever like sport, movement pattern, whatever into practice, right? And so when you're looking at practice, there's this thing called block practice where you do the exact same thing over and over again. And then there's sequential where it's like, I'm always going to do A followed by B followed by C followed by D. And then there's random, where it's like, you know, I still have those same letters A through Z of drills or whatever, and I'm just going to at random do them. And what you find time and time again is that when people do block practice, they get better at that exact scenario. And then when you do, you know, sequential, they don't look as good as they did for that exact scenario as the people who do block practice, but they do better in real life scenario. And then the same is true for people who do random things. So, you know, when you're testing them in like a confined setting, they don't do as well. But when you're putting them into the real world, they do well. I promise I'm going to bring this around. And that if we look at physical development as the entire of life, right? If life is the entire sequence of practice, if you are doing the same thing every single year over and over again, you are going to get really good at that one thing and have huge glaring holes in others, which is why we have kids throw out their shoulders and have multiple, you know, surgeries by the time they're 17 years old. Versus if we took, again, looking at the big spectrum, if we took more of a random approach, and if that approach is different sports that they can participate in, so that way they can develop, you know, different things, because each sport has something to offer, but also lacks something else. So that way we can develop well-rounded, you know, robust bodies and minds by the time they're now entering the truly competitive phase of like high school, to go into college, to go on further, if that's what they are. But then also robust bodies that can just survive, you know, the world and the fire service. Like, I see it in the academies where people have played a single sport for a really, really long time, and we're constantly battling, you know, the same injury that is from that sport. And we're not playing the sport anymore, but we're still seeing like the effects of it, I guess, is a good way of saying it.
I think one of the areas that we've done a lot of damage as well is this whole participation trophy conversation. Because again, it's sending the message that if you didn't win, then, you know, who, as you said, who are you? You didn't win. So what was the point? Why did you even show up? You didn't win. Mm-hmm. Rather than, and I point this out all the time, if you go to a Tough Mudder and you run a half marathon with all these obstacles and get electrocuted and climb under barbed wire, and at the end, what do they put around your neck? A participation trophy. Does it mean that you didn't put any effort in? No, you just ran a half marathon through mud and barbed wire and electrical wires. So there's a difference between, and I've never witnessed this to date, a team of kids that put zero effort in that they just gave a bunch of trophies to. But I've seen lots of children that showed up for practice week in, week out, in the rain, in the cold, in the heat, tried their hardest and just weren't the best kids on the field and didn't win. So, but they got a trophy to say, you showed up all season and you put the work in. So I think that kind of rhetoric, which again comes from the same roided out beard wearing ding dongs that we see on Instagram, or the ones that are in the, you know, the lazy boys that never even do any exercise themselves, is that we should be encouraging kids to just play. Like you said, in Spain, you know, you have the elitism. Okay, that's great. You go be on the television, and everyone else, it's called playing sport. You're not supposed to win every single game. No sports team on the planet has ever won every single game. So I think that's a very damaging narrative as well, is to dissuade children by saying, if you didn't win, you don't deserve a trophy.
Yeah, I think what this also brings up for me is like this classification of athlete as well, in that like something that I see now that I feel like I didn't see 15, 10 years ago is that now everybody's an athlete, which, like, don't get me wrong, I want everybody moving. I think there are things that every human being should be able to do. And I think they should have qualities that most people would consider athletic. But in my opinion, similar to how, like, if you go out in sport and playing the game is like cool, you like, if you go out and play soccer, you are a soccer player. That is like, there's the pride. And then if you win, awesome, then you get a trophy or whatever it is. But like, you're out playing soccer. I think, and again, this is a bias that I recognize, I think having been a highly competitive athlete and having worked with highly competitive athletes who like put every, like, I was considering working at like a part-time at a bank just so that way I could train. Like, the things that, in my opinion, athletes do because they compete. Now, whether that be at a recreational level, but like they have some skin in the game of like, I'm actually going up against somebody to like measure quote unquote who's best. Then I get to like make that claim, versus like the participation trophy, in my opinion, for adults is like them getting to call themselves an athlete. It's like, cool, if you're going to be an athlete, like you got to prove it somewhere. Because people don't get to call themselves like an NBA player not playing the NBA. Not that, you know, most people are playing in the NBA, but like, to me, that's the participation trophy of an adult. Is they're like, I'm an athlete. I'm like, you should be in shape. But like, athletes compete. Are you competing? Yes. Okay, great. Then cool. Love that for you. But yeah, that's my little soapbox of, of like, you know, participation trophies.
Yeah. No, I was an athlete, martial artist. So I did compete in Taekwondo, won national tournaments, but again, you know, at my weight, at my belt, in my division. So when you kind of filter it down, it wasn't like I beat everyone in the UK, every fighter by any means. It's good. It's a great achievement. So, and then when I went to university, my sports science lecturers were actually Taekwondo coaches. So I fought for my college then as well.
That's cool.
So I got a taste of that. It's kind of a good segue though. But then I enter the fire service. All of a sudden I shift now to tactical athlete, which I think is far more important than, you know, the little high kicking men on the top of a plastic trophy. So let's kind of transition then. And if you want to put your disclaimer in now, this would be a good time to do it. Talk to me about the front door when you first went into Pflugerville. You know, any kind of myths that you brought in that were busted? And then what was the kind of environment when you walked through the front?
Yeah. So just quick disclaimer, anything that I share here is my personal opinion and my experience. It doesn't reflect the opinion of that of my employer, right? And so some really interesting things that I learned even just in the like application process that I didn't know, and that it's something that I share with coaches who say they want to come into tactical now, is like, everybody thinks tactical, and by nature, a lot of the things that apply to the military, they think apply overall. So like, having grown up around the military, like, I know that like people have to make specific like fitness standards, and they're being tested on their fitness on minimally an annual basis and so on and so forth. I thought that like that was true in the fire service, and not because I knew of anything, just because I made the assumption that like, oh, well, like it would make sense for them to be in shape. They're all over the country. And, you know, I knew that the NFPA existed, but I didn't know like recommendation versus requirement and all these things, right, going in, I was like, oh, it would make sense that every firefighter on the planet, or at least in our country, like, does that. And so that was a huge, like, myth busted in itself. And that I was like, okay, learning that's not the case. And then what was even crazier to me was that, like, we could be, you know, a single department can butt up to another department and they can do things completely differently, that they really were, you know, all these individual little islands that, like, obviously work together, but do things completely differently, which is, like, that was something that blew my mind coming in to work with a fire service. And so, when I came in to start working with Pflugerville, it was so much fun. We were small. I mean, we're still relatively small, a little over 200 people now, but there was only 75 people there when I first started. And so, you know, I got to know every single person, essentially, like, I was coaching just one football team, like, that's the amount of people, right, I was dealing with. And so I wasn't the first attempt at health and fitness within our department. I was hired in 2016. They actually started some of that in 2011 with, like, some annual testing. And then they had hired a contractor who came in. He was a gentleman who owned a local gym to train the firefighters. And I think, unfortunately, didn't know either A, who he was working with and their needs, or B, the ability to do that was outside of his skill set. And he just maybe wasn't aware of that. But unfortunately, he left a bad taste in their mouth for exercise people, quote unquote, coming in. But the good news is he was the complete opposite of me. And so, from my understanding, he looked a little bit, you know, like the ding dong bearded, alpha macho, do this because it's hard, not like, hey, we're going to do this, which is actually what's going to make you better at X, Y, and Z from, like, a progressive standpoint. It's like, eat dirt because then you're tough, kind of thing. And so he was like, I was the complete opposite of him. And so either A, I was welcomed with open arms, or B, I was met with skepticism because of their previous experience. But I think with time, getting to know people, you know, effectively coaching people, so on and so forth, like, that dissipated pretty quickly when they learned, oh, this is not that. And so, yeah, that's kind of what I met up front. There was a little resistance up front, as there is with anything, but I think I had a relatively, quote unquote, like, easy going of it in comparison to other people who are starting programs at departments.
What was your training philosophy when you first entered? Because, you know, there's so much evolution in this world the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. How did you kind of view the tactical athlete in training them year one, and how has that evolved to 2025?
I still have it. It's people might not like this, but, like, the mindset I had going in was that firefighters are not athletes, because my definition of an athlete was somebody who was putting their training above everything else. So, like, a lot of times when I was working with student athletes, it wasn't hard to get them to train. It wasn't hard to get them to come to practice. It was hard to get them to, like, do their homework, mm-hmm. Go to class. Like, they were athlete students. And so what you could ask of them before they would gripe, what you could push them to before they would be like, yeah, I'm not doing that, was pretty high. Because also, like, they're at a point where, like, they've been doing this to some degree for so long. It is the status quo of training. And so they have relatively high training ages, depending on, you know, whether they're freshmen or seniors, that changes. But, like, I know what their bodies are currently capable of, so on and so forth, based on the sport demand, all these things. And so going in, I brought the methodology of high quality training. That applies to anybody, in my opinion, whether we're talking about the collegiate athlete, the firefighter, or like my 70-year-old grandma, or, you know, by a desk jockey who does that. Like, high quality training is high quality training. It looks at, hey, what are the demands? Where do they currently sit? So what are they lacking to reach those demands, and how can we make them more robust? In my opinion, that's not training an athlete. That's just high quality training, regardless of who you're talking about. And so that was my approach in taking that. And what I did at the time, especially because we had so few people, is there were some points of autonomy where you could choose what you were doing, but we were all going to do the same thing. So that way I knew that everybody could move sufficiently in overall movement patterns. Because once they know how to do that, then we can start doing, you know, some real fun things, or those who want can push even further. But if you push far on, you know, unstable joints, weak systems, that's how people end up getting hurt. And so it has always been my approach, and still is my approach, to like build a robust human body in a way that they enjoy it. What has changed, maybe not drastically, but maybe has become more of an emphasis now, you know, in 2025 versus then, is that I think the largest component of my job is for people to have a positive experience with health and fitness. And I make that clear to everybody who comes in and wants to work with us, whether or not like that. I have a few like contracted coaches that come in and work. I have an assistant coach, or like just, you know, anybody who wants to come in and speak on it and so on and so forth, or my health and fitness work group, which is like my peer fitness trainers essentially. And that our job is to give people a positive experience with health and fitness. And like, if there is a time to like, you know, light a fire under their ass, we will do that. But whatever that positive, whatever they're looking for in terms of positive, we provide that to the best of our ability, for the reason we talked about with the Uncle Rico's, in that like, I don't want people to stop training. And even if they don't like it, they at least understand the importance of it. So they'll do something in a way that carries them through their career and beyond. That is probably the biggest thing that has changed for me.
Brilliant. Well, you mentioned about moving sufficiently. Talk to me about the kind of physical hiring standards, and what is the spectrum of candidate that you're getting at the front door?
Yeah, so our hiring standards now they seem relatively low. And I'll talk about why, in that we require people to do, we actually don't require CPET up front. And we can talk about why here in a bit. But we require people to do a minimum of 7 push-ups to a 5-inch block and an 80 beats per minute metronome, a minute side plank on each side, and then a 5K bike test to an equivalent of estimated 8 met VO2 max. And so this has changed a lot. That's recent, as of the last, what year is it? 2025. So I would say since 2021. And we've gone through a couple iterations. When I first started working there, passing the CPAT was a requirement up front. And then we did a mass hiring of paramedics, and then got them their fire, like help. Obviously they got it, but like put them through a fire academy to get their fire cert so that they were firefighter paramedics. And they got like a year to pass the CPAT upon hiring. And then it was 6 months upon hiring, so that way we keep them, because, and again, a lot of this is all above me. It's more of just like, how can we fill the need? And we needed paramedics at the time, so we hired a bunch of them and did that. And then as of 2021, I think the hiring started in 2022. Don't quote me on the exact year. They all kind of blend together. But we did a, we now do cadet academies. So people come in with or without their, their certs, and then go through a full-on academy. The first one we did, we actually had zero requirements. And so the zero requirements resulted in a higher failure rate for sure. But what they allowed us to do was to kind of see if people come in at this, you know, being this fit, then we can get them to where we need them to be. And so that's where we came with those standards that I just mentioned, with the goal being get the best people and train them to be fit. Because like anybody with high quality training and the right mentality can get in good shape. They just maybe didn't have the opportunity. Maybe they didn't have the knowledge, so on and so forth. And so I would say from a fitness perspective, we take an inclusive standpoint because we have the infrastructure to train them and get them where they need to be.
If you could be queen for a day and write a test of where a tactical athlete, a firefighter should be, what would that look like?
Like a singular test?
Like if this person passes this test and they get a high rise fire and have to climb 20 stories with 100 pounds of gear, that person will be able to smash it. That kind of test.
And but are they currently a firefighter or not?
Yes. No. So someone who's in, because the thing is, and we'll get to this in a minute. There's two paths to being a firefighter. There's one that a lot of us did where we put ourselves through the academy, you know, and then certainly 20 years ago when I was testing, had to compete against thousands of people to get, you know, one of 20, 30 jobs. And then absolutely needs a place as well. There's a second, as you said, citizens one, you know, with mentorship that I would argue allows people in underserved communities who can't afford to put themselves through fire academy, maybe it never even came across their radar in their particular community, to also, you know, become a phenomenal firefighter as well. But those two intersect at someone who's truly ready to be on a rig now. So at that point, they're about to walk through the fire station. They could get who knows what come through as their first call. Fitness test for that person, male or female.
Do I get to put them through a battery of tests, or is it literally just one? Okay. Because I think that's important as well, in that, first of all, any one test that you pick is never going to be perfect, because it's always going to miss the mark on something. It's always going to miss the mark on something, because even if you were like, hey, I'm going to make it like a structure fire. Well, is it the structure fire where I'm climbing 20 stairs, or is it, you know, a structure fire where instead of like I'm going up, I'm now, you know, searching for an expansive amount in a commercial building, and like those two similar but also different demands? Or am I on a, you know, a, like even though we're structural firefighters, we still work grass fires where I'm out there walking for 3 miles or whatever. So there would be one, I said, maybe I tell you what we currently do now, which by no means do I think is perfect currently. And then we can go from there. And that, one, they would do some kind of occupational type testing in gear. And so, we kind of use we kill two birds with one stone, in that in gear, we run through, we call it the consumption drill, because we do measure, you know, the amount of air you consume during that time. But also it's based off of an assessment that has a ton of research behind it, really out of Canada, to say like, hey, if you can do, you know, these, it's either 8 or 10, I don't remember off the top of my head, depending on how you count them, events, and they're, you know, in gear, they're climbing up and down ladders, they're throwing ladders, so on and so forth, dragging dummies, pulling sleds, these sorts of things. Not that you actually pull a sled, but just to mimic the strength required, right? So some kind of like occupational type obstacle course in that setting, meeting those metrics. So again, ours is based off of the research that had been done over a couple decades, the course of a couple decades. And so it's finishing that within 8 minutes. Okay. There would definitely be a requirement of a VO2 max test and how you want to, you know, measure that, whether it be running or biking or, you know, whatever that may be. And what's good about that is you can estimate that, even not perfect, but also like really cost effective when we're talking about departments that are like shoestringing some budgets together. And so there would be some way to measure their VO2 max, and it would not be stratified by age or by sex. It would be regardless of who you are at. We would be at a minimum of 10 METs. That would be a minimum. In my opinion, I do think like shooting for the 12 is actually ideal. And people can come at me for that, but I think a minimum of 10. And so we would have those two. We would have, depending on your, and I think this is where things change too, depending on the area you serve and kind of what that looks like, whether we're talking like, because like in your instance where you're saying like, hey, somebody has to make it up 20 flights of steps, we don't even have a building that's that like half that tall. I think our highest is 5. And so not to say that that isn't important, but your ability to cover ground for a long period of time in our case could be more helpful because we do run some grass fires and things like that. So it would be some kind of like longer endurance event. Whether or not you wanted that to be like, I think the bare minimum of that, what we use is the NWCG pack walk test, which I, by no means do I think is the highest standard in any way, shape or form. But that could work. Or if you were doing something like a timed test on like a really high tower. But again, I don't know what the like magic measurement for that would be. You'd have to like run a few things, look at some data to come up with that. And then we do one last one, which I think isn't as crucial to saying, hey, you were clear to be a firefighter, but I think is crucial from a personal fitness development type thing, where you would put them through a battery of tests like vertical jump, you know, understanding their weight, body fat percentage, skeletal muscle mass, things like that. Some kind of maximal strength lift, whether or not like that's a rep max, like type deadlift or squat, or we use an isometric mid thigh pull, muscular endurance in terms of pushups, inverted rows, side planks for low back health, and some kind of like field test, which would qualify as your VO2 max, like estimator. That was a ton of rambling, and I don't feel like I answered your question.
No, you did, because you're spitballing at this point. Firstly, it's funny you mentioned the pack test. I've had a few, you know, quite a few wild band people on here, and I always ask them, you know, is that up a hill? And they're like, no, it's flat.
No, it's totally flat.
Let me get this straight. The test that you have to be a wildland firefighter involves climbing up mountains, is walking a mile and a half on a flat road.
Yeah. So. You know, I don't know if you know who Austin Womack is, but he is a, I met him because he was a strength coach for the Austin Fire Department at the time. He now works for Cal Fire. He is serves in the, not National Guard, but the Army Reserve, National Guard. Don't hate me on if I get that wrong. But he was a, you know, a collegiate and a professional strength and conditioning coach. He's also been a wildland firefighter previous to his strength coach career, post to his strength coach career. And he is one of the people trying to kind of revolutionize strength and conditioning in the wildland firefighting world. And so, yeah, by no means is it the test. But if we're looking at something, hey, that's a little bit longer endurance based. Because here's the thing, you can like, and almost every firefighter that I've encountered can like, you can suffer through the suck for 10 minutes. which like a lot of when we're talking about like even the operational type obstacle courses, like 10, 15 minutes, it takes something different to do something for 45. Not only in terms of like energy systems and your aerobic capacity and these sorts of things, but like really just like the mental aspect of it as well. And so that's why I think doing something with a longer type time frame is important.
One of my guests said something quite a while ago now, but it really stuck with me. He said, the people that are, you know, bucking fitness standards are basically saying that they're scared to be tired. And I was like, God, that is so spot on. And then if you really reframe that, then do you want the person who is in that room with you to be scared to be tired? That's the worst thing you could possibly have, is someone that's going to tap out as the moment they get uncomfortable. So this is where this importance of these high fitness standards really lies, is, you know, when you do these, you know, incrementally and you work up to a high level of fitness, and then you have those red line workouts that really are horrible once a week, whatever it ends up being, you know, when you get into that life or death situation, you're okay being uncomfortable. You've got the muscular capacity, the aerobic endurance to see through whatever needs to be done. But if you've lowered the bar to where someone's worst day happens in the fire room, that is an absolute recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I think most people would say, I'm not afraid to be tired. And they're like, okay, you may not be afraid of it, but if your body can't take it, then you should be afraid of it. And that, like, some people approach it in that sense. They're like, well, I ain't scared. I just don't want to do it. And it's like, cool. And why is that? You know, and even like, I think the really important thing that you just kind of like, you know, barely touched on, but is the incremental process of it happening is so important. I think a lot of people are, you know, understandably so, either scared or their pushback comes from maybe not seeing that picture of it being gradual, of being like, cool, well, I know I'm not there right now. So if you were to implement them as is right now, I'd be on the chopping block, or, you know, however you want to phrase it, I'd be in trouble. But okay, you're not there now, but what if we gave you the tools to get there by X amount of time? I was on a panel a couple weeks ago, and there was a chief on it who I think said something so beautifully. He said, you love your people by holding them to high standards and supporting them to reach those high standards. And I don't care what we're talking about, whether it be fitness or, you know, EMS skills or fire skills or whatever it may be, like, people say they're the best, which, like, I want people to be the best, right? Because when my family needs you, I want you to be the best. Like, I don't live in Pflugerville, but the reason I want to live in Pflugerville is because I know that if anything happens to my family, they are A-okay. And so you want them to be the best. And so, cool, hold them to those high standards. You have to say, here's what the best is, but also, like, here's how we get there. And should you fall, we're going to say, like, hey, you probably shouldn't have fallen. However, here's how we don't fall in the future. Like, let's recognize whatever happened so that way it doesn't happen again. And then let's get you back up to where now you don't have to fall, or you are less likely. You have more options, so that way you don't fall. Whether we're talking like, hey, somebody literally fell and rolled their ankle, guess what? I'm going to help them build a robust system to where now they can jump on one foot from left to right. Guess what? They're less likely to roll an ankle at that point. So how do we give them whatever support they need in order to, like, you know, figuratively jump from left to right on an ankle, whether that be in fitness in my realm or EMS skills, fire skills, leadership, so on and so forth.
This is the pushback you get when you talk about fitness standards, is, oh, you're just trying to take our jobs. And my thing is, firstly, well, what kind of illusion did you have at the front door? Did you not go to a fire academy? Did they not make you wear your gear and carry hose up flights and flights of stairs and drag dummies and chop wood and do all these things that are really hard, and you get hot and you get tired? That was the front door. So the fact that you're even having the audacity to say you're trying to take our jobs, you know, is the assumption that no one told you it was going to be hard, which is complete rubbish. So, you know, exactly like you said, the solution is to put these standards in place. But of course, that doesn't mean tomorrow you have to be, you know, doing 12 METs. If you've fallen behind, and I think the work week is a big part of this, because that doesn't give you an environment to stay in shape, to, you know, control your body composition, to keep your testosterone high. So once we fix that as a profession, now we have to go from this, you know, protecting people that are out of shape and look at it as the complete opposite, which is if you really love your people, you will fight for fitness standards so they have longevity in their career and longevity in retirement. But then there has to be an on-ramp process, you know, a year, 18 months. Okay, here's, you know, we're going to help you. We've got peer fitness trainers. We're going to do all the things we can. But then you're going to have two types of people. You're going to have the person who became incrementally deconditioned that works their way back up, huge success. And you're going to have some of them that have no intention of putting the work in. And you're going to have to have the conversation like, all right, well, then what else do you want to do? We've got some openings in fire prevention. But apart from that, you know, because you're not fitting the standards, and you speak to special forces, special operations, ocean lifeguards, and you say, what if someone said, I don't want to work out, it's too hard? How long would you last in those teams? You wouldn't. You'd be gone.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
So you have to also put your big girl and boy pants on and draw a line in the sand and say, look, for someone to be deemed ready to be on a truck company or an engine company or on a rescue, you have to be able to do the job. And we told you that in day one in Florida, our certification is named minimum standards. That's as shit as you should ever be your entire career. We labeled it for you. So don't turn around now and say it's not fair when we ask you to be held to a standard, because it was always fair.
Yeah. When we get on these discussions, I think something that comes up for me often as well is when people are trying to support those people, that is where having, I will always argue to have a professional in place. And now that doesn't mean you have to have necessarily an entirely full-time position like I do. But how can you figure out how to work with somebody whose expertise is health and fitness? Because this, for the same reason that you have experienced people teaching your EMS skills, in my opinion, you should have an experienced person at least overseeing the teaching of this and being able to put the right methodology in place. Because I think what unfortunately does happen many times in that, you know, we have the people who are sitting well below where they need to be, right? Well below those minimum standards that you speak of. And the message that is said to them is well, you fucking signed on the dotted line, get your shit together and go. Which, also, I probably should have checked if I could cuss in here, but
you can.
Okay, good, because I do a lot. Which, I agree with. You did sign on the dotted line, and so you do need to get your shit together and go. But if everybody is just telling them that, and they're the person who's I don't that's not working for me, because when I did walk through that front door, those standards weren't implicitly said, or even implied. The implication was hey, you got in, attaboy, you did it. And so, in all fairness, that's what they walked into. And so if we are trying to change that, we need to do it in a way where we can allow those people to give a shit. And so having somebody be there to truly support them in a way that makes sense is huge. And there was one gentleman, he's one of my favorite people on the planet. When I first showed up, he made it very clear. And he says, I do not like exercise. I do not enjoy exercise. I will hate the entire time you come here. And I said, okay. He said, but you're going to do something. And he said, I have to. And so I will. I said, cool. You're going to walk on this treadmill. And he did. Every time I showed up, every time I came around the stations, we would run our workout. He would walk on the treadmill. He'd walk on the treadmill. And, you know, the more times I came, the more questions I would ask him. I would ask about his family. I would ask about like what his kids were into, what activities were they doing, so on and so forth. It took 3 months and finally said, Vanessa, I'm going to join y'all today. And I said, cool. Like, didn't make a big deal out of it. It's like when your kid finally eats the green vegetable, you're like, cool. And inside I'm like, yes, did it. Right. But I didn't show up and say like, well, you fucking signed on the dotted line, get your shit together, let's go. Because I'm working with grown ass adults who have made their own decisions up until this point. And again, when they walked through those front doors, the expectations that currently exist were not there. And you can say, like, you know, I can beat the drum as loud as I can. And for some people, beating the drum works. But for other people's, you need, for other people's, well, for other people, you just need to like have a bit of a quieter conversation with them and kind of like, you know, like the timid animal you're trying to feed, like let them come to you and simply be there. Now, obviously there's a time frame for that, but you still have to, I think, keep in mind, like approach this in a way. And it's different if I'm, you know, you're a battalion chief coming from it, or like if you're the peer fitness trainer or the coach in my perspective, like coming to it, you have different roles to play.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've saw that myself a couple of times in departments like California. When I was there was a culture of fitness, and again, they had, I worked out the other day, I was the top 1% of this list for the first class after attrition through probationary year. Mm. So that's how competitive it was, 1%. And so they had a culture of fitness. So when I think about it, you know, the crews that I was on, we were always, whether it was volleyball, actual workouts, you know, that's where I got introduced to CrossFit back in 2006. My friend came back and was swinging this cannonball with a handle. I'm like, what are you doing? And so, you know, so there was that culture at the front door. So even though they didn't have specific fitness standards, you know, you'd been through such a crucible that that's the kind of human being that you were. And anyone that even started slipping, the rest of the crew just brought them back up and we got them back involved. Mm-hmm. But it's also the environment. Like I said, I'm always very careful to say, look, you know, if you're going to have mandatory overtime all the time and you're working people 80 hours a week, how can you then turn around and say you're going to hold them to a fitness standard when you haven't even given them the environment to thrive? But you've also got to walk the walk yourself. And this, I saw my social media blow up after Pete Hegseth, is that his name's speech to the military about, you know, they all need to be in shape now. And it's like, well, that's all well and good. But your same group that you're attached to, your political party, also said that they were going to make America healthy again. And we haven't heard a damn thing about that till almost a year. Well, who are you recruiting from? America. So you're telling the military members that they need to be in shape, but you're doing nothing to make Americans be in shape. You haven't fixed anything post-COVID. There's not organic farms being bolstered now. There's not PE programs being put back in schools. You know, all these things that have to be in place as well. So I agree with you completely. You know, build it, they will come. You got to set a standard. And that's what I was going to say. But there was other stations where I would be out there on my own doing a CrossFit workout for weeks. And then one day someone would come, and then I'd be two of us, and then three of us, then four of us. Then I'd be on days off and visit the station, and my crew would still be working out without me. That's exactly what you're talking about. But, you know, there's also, you know, that environmental ownership where we've got to fix the work week. We've got to have the upper echelon that are also in shape. You can't just, you know, virtue signal fitness without walking the walk and then create an environment that allows it to happen in the first place.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of people struggle in the same sense that, like, in my opinion, the fire service is just like a microscope on like the American public, and that like the same issues that the American public has in terms of like, you know, diabetes, sleep apnea, how, like all of their blood markers, so on and so forth, the struggle to exercise, all of the things, it all happens in the fire service as well. Now, the stakes are high in that the general population doesn't have the risk of dying as the fire service has because they don't do a job that can kill them on a daily basis. But the struggles are still there, because even if the environment, like at our department, we offer overtime for people to work out. Like they can stay up to like, it essentially comes out to like twice a week. You can work out for an hour and get paid to do that, which is amazing. And honestly, that wasn't my idea. That was, the fire chief's idea, and thankfully we've been able to keep that the entire time that I'm there, trying to provide like an answer to this barrier of like, well, it's important that you work out, and so here's an opportunity for that. But like, life is still busy, life is still hard. And so, and I understand that. Like I've worked for the fire service for almost 10 years now. And 5 years ago, I guess 7 years ago, my husband was like, cool, I want to be a firefighter. So like, I live that life as well. And he works 24, 48. It's like, I understand this struggle. I'm a strength coach and I still struggle to fit all the things in all the time. And so I get that. And so I think an important piece is like the educational component, and almost to like bring this back to what we talked about with like these kids, right? It should be like the joy of the game that keeps you playing, whether or not like, cool, I get to, you know, play, I get to practice 5 times a week and then compete at a high level on the weekend. Like that's the peak of the pyramid, right? But if I'm not there, then okay, maybe I get to exercise 3 times a week and, you know, try and eat a vegetable, which it seems like silly in quotation marks conversations to have with grown people who are doing a job that can kill them. But it's the reality of where we are, because life is really freaking hard and everybody is busy, and people, the majority of firefighters in the country are not working a 24/72. And so they're trying to fit in all the things and, you know, be the parents that they are, be the spouses they want to be, and still like find time to rest. Like it's incredibly difficult. And so I get that. And so I think the education always needs to be, and the message needs to be like, hey, you might not be, you know, at peak level 10 because life is stressful right now. Maybe you're dealing with X, Y, and Z, but can you be at like 7.5? So that way when life slows down, great, I can now bump up to an 8. I can bump up to an 8.5 and so on and so forth. And like ride the ebbs and flows that is life. I think so often the fire service, it's human nature in one, but I think especially two in the fire service, it is so all or nothing. And also like, because firefighters' jobs are like, problem presents, I solve. Because like, you are called to a problem. Your job is literally to solve that problem well enough until you can hand it off to people who can solve it even further. Which like, is great, but also is really difficult in the sense that if that is the pathway I am used to of like, problem here, problem solved, problem here, problem solved, versus like, I'm going to have to constantly work on this. It is an ever evolving problem that actually can never be solved because we're constantly moving the goalpost to a degree, is hard. And I get that. And I think it needs to be said, because like, they get it. Life's hard, but we got to do it.
Well, I think this goes back as well, just to flog the horse one more time with the 24/72. And it's great because we're talking, you're in Texas. Plano just became the first department in Texas.
I just listened to that podcast you did with the city manager from there. Yeah.
Yep. So there we go. He's broken the dam now. So we'll see who's next in Texas. But, you know, this is it. If we're going to ask people to be there on everyone's worst day, we've got to create space for training, for time with family, for rest and recovery and sleep, you know, mobility and hydration and all the other things that we talk about, because these are, you know, I mean, they are athletes, tactical athletes, and they're using that for a reason, because, you know, God forbid you have a, you know, 9/11 or a Vegas shooting, you are going to have to operate at an extremely high physical level and, you know, a mental acuity level as well. So imperative. I know we're kind of getting short of time now, so I want to hit Firefighter Strength Coach. So outside of Pflugerville, yeah. Talk to me about the programming you offer everyone.
Yeah, so it's funny. When my kid was one, I had a firefighter say like, hey, you should like kind of bottle this up and share this with the world, like what you've done here. I'd been at the fire department for, I guess, 3 years at that point. And I said, you should kind of bottle this up and share this with the world. And I was like, that sounds like a great idea. But I was in the throes of having a newborn. My husband was in EMT school. Like, I was like, absolutely not. No. And then a couple years ago, I was finally like, okay, it's time to like start kind of sharing what I've been lucky enough to, you know, do and help firefighters with and things like that. And so when, and I was also tired of people like coming up to me, showing me their phone and be like, hey, have you seen this? And it's like some guy online, like spewing bullshit about, you know, getting sun for 92 minutes first thing in the morning. And that's what he has to do. And that's why he can't make the health gains, because I don't get 92 minutes of sunlight in the morning. And so I can't be healthier. And it's like, okay. So, that's when I made the, you know, constantly regrettable decision to start like putting things out online to share with the world and try and not only improve, like, you know, the fire department that I work with full time, but also like the lives and fire departments of those around. And so I've gotten to do some really cool things. I've gotten to go out and speak at different symposiums, seminars. I've gotten to write articles, both for like individual departments to share with their departments or kind of with some bigger blogs and things like that. I've gone out and taught workshops at fire departments. I've worked with departments on policymaking, on how to implement fitness standards and consulted on that. I've also worked with firefighters like on a one-on-one basis. Or also have a few programs that float around out there as well to help them kind of fill the gap that I see exists right now in the fire, like in the fire service on a national conversation. Like I have one program, it's called Ignition, and it's about like getting people into training. Like there's so much out there that's like, hey, here's the exercise plan that currently exists. Like here's your 4 to 5 times a week, blah, 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 all these things. And it's like, cool. I have people who, and like knock on wood, I don't have, but there are firefighters out there that like currently don't exercise at all. And so like, how do we talk to them in a way that makes sense for the fire service, like ties everything back to what they do, not only to like how important their job is and their purpose in that, but also like you are more than a firefighter. And my goal ultimately is for you to like live strong lives. That's my tagline, like strong work, strong mind, strong lives. And that like outside of being a firefighter, I want you to be able to do the things that you want to do. Once you've decided your fire career is over, and I say you decided because you didn't have to medically retire because your back couldn't handle it anymore, because your shoulder was like, you know, just couldn't do it. Like once you decide you are done with your career in the fire service, like you get to also do the amazing things that you would like to do. And so kind of that is everything that is Firefighter Strength Coach in one.
Beautiful. And for people listening, mm-hmm. Where can they find that, the website and then you online as far as social media?
Yeah. So I am mostly on Instagram, Firefighter Strength Coach, and then just firefighterstrengthcoach.com. The blog that's up there. And so there's a ton of free resources on there. Not a ton, there should be more, but there are free resources on there for people to not only get started, but there's like, you speak a lot about testosterone. There's a testosterone guide on my website as well. And so, yeah, you can find me online.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank Trevor again, and I want to thank you so much. I think we need to do another interview down the road because we didn't even really dip into programming or any of that area.
I would love to. And I think it's important to like talk both, right? And not like, hey, we've got to talk, you know, the big things that kind of get us here. And then let's talk nitty gritty for the people who like, you know, want to hear us nerd out about all that stuff.
Absolutely. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.